You're listening to a Cripple and Co. production.
Welcome to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities, an inclusive podcast focused on queer, disabled, and marginalized creatives and their art. This is the bit where I ask for help. You can now support the show by signing up as a patron on Patreon. I absolutely love putting the podcast together, but unfortunately, it costs money. I'd also really like to be able to add a transcription to the podcast, as I know that there's some people out there who would really benefit from having that kind of access. Unfortunately, that's not something I can do myself. However, there are apps that will do it for me, but they also cost money. If you can afford to help me keep the podcast going and help me get the transcription service in place, please sign up to my Patreon for as little as £1 a month on patreon.com/agparker. If there's another way you'd like to donate, please do get in touch. I'm definitely interested in selling ad space on the podcast, and any other donations are most welcome. And now, on with the show. Welcome to Cabinet of Curiosities. Today we have got Kestrel Guyon. Kestrel is a transgender author, playwright, poet and performer from the United Kingdom. She is currently represented by Reconnecting Rainbows Press for literary works with a new book called 28, due for release in February 2023. Her stage credits include musical theatre, opera and plays. She has a voice acting portfolio spanning video games, animation and corporate work. Behind the scenes, she has worked in production, management and video mixing at a pre and post-production level. Well, Kestrel, that's quite a bio. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm doing well, thanks. That was a very meticulously read bio. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I do that, I suppose.
Do you not feel like you do all those things?
Well, I mean, I do. I'm always tired, so I must do all those things. But it's that kind of... you know, you never kind of think of it all in the same breath. Like when I'm doing one thing, and then like the next day I'll be doing another. It's
yeah. Do you have that ability then to just focus on one project at a time, or do you find you're spinning plates all at the same time constantly?
I mean, I love spinning plates. Plate spinning is a great trick. Sometimes I forget which plates are up in the air and which plates are in the cupboard, but I do love spinning plates. I think it's beautiful. Sometimes I break a plate. Sometimes it turns out that a plate was a bowl all along. So,
I mean, I love a good bowl. Who doesn't love a good bowl?
It's when you're spinning something and then suddenly you think, actually, that's a spoon. It's like, you know, things sometimes take you by surprise. Life comes at you fast.
It does. It does. Throws you a curve bowl, one might say. Oh, God, I'm sorry. The puns have begun.
That's funny. I was assigned curveball at birth.
You're going to make me snort, and that's within the first 2 minutes of this podcast. So this is very dangerous. So your work spans multiple genres and styles. Do you have a favourite?
A favourite genre or a favourite work?
Anything. Answer as you see fit.
I definitely have a favourite type of bagel. Favorite sandwich? That would be a tough one. What is my favorite everything? It's hard. I am really, really eclectic and interdisciplinary and very weird. I think I'd just describe myself as weird. So I kind of like different things depending on my mood. Genre-wise, I don't know. It's so hard to pin down kind of what's the favorite, because really I can be in the mood for something like super cute and gay, or I can be in the mood for something kind of gritty and sci-fi. I can be in the mood for kind of tackling like big mental health projects, and then 5 minutes later all I want is a cupcake and a sit at the piano and play some music. So it's kind of, I'm one of those people that everything is my favorite. There's not really much that ever gets me not excited. I'm kind of a little ball of energy bouncing around between everything,
which is absolutely incredible. And I'm gonna add in, so on top of the bits in the bio that I read out, you've also had your poetry turned into a song. You've had your audio drama The Cat in the Flat recorded by some really brilliant actors. You've been in a punk rock band, performed opera on stage, and done a whole lot of volunteering. Like Kestrel.
None of those things are even my day job. It's as you know, any kind of artist that has to have their day job to be able to afford their rent. It's I just I'm never satisfied, I guess. I mean, I am. I love what I do, and I'm so happy with so many of the things that I've worked on. But I'm never happy to just sit back. I guess like one thing's done, and then I'm like, great, okay, good. What's the next thing? I don't really rest much.
And is that, would you say that that's a healthy drive, or is that kind of like more of a frenetic you have that? Because I know often for myself, I get that energy building up and I feel almost quite unwell until I kind of get something out and I hammer something away at my keyboard or make some kind of weird drag set. So is it a good energy or a bad energy, or just
I
a
wouldn't call it bad energy, but I would say maybe don't emulate me. Like I'm not the thing to strive for. I just have this kind of impulsive need to do things and create things and bring things into being. I mean, I'm a fidget. I'm a kind of very energy driven person. I don't like doing nothing. And apparently, I don't even like just doing one or two things because I quite like to keep really busy. So I think you know, it's not bad energy. It doesn't hurt, but it does need to get out. I have this kind of energy that always needs to be satiated, I suppose. So I'm always working on something.
That's really interesting. I realized that actually, no, you're right. It's obviously not bad energy. And also, who am I to label anything good or bad? But I think for me, when I have that same, it needs to come out feeling, often it smacks straight into my disability. And the two are not compatible. And so I end up being very frustrated. So no, like you're completely right. It's a good drive of energy, but not always possible to satiate, as you say.
I think interestingly, I've spent quite a lot of my life coming out of different closets. I think maybe just the need to have things, kind of bring things out into the open and kind of have everything come out of me, I think is probably tied into that in some way. I mean, I've always been able to, or I've always kind of strived to live who I am on my sleeve, on my chest, and wear it proudly. And I think the same goes for everything else that I do. It's very rare for me to have an unexpressed thought.
It's wonderful that you've got so many different ways that you can express those thoughts as well. Your poetry collection, Counterweights, is deeply personal, and is that one of the ways that you find you can get things out and express yourself?
That's right, yeah, and it is personal, as is quite a lot of what I do. There's a lot of kind of me in all of the things that I create, and I think part of that is that I'm not particularly shy or embarrassed about who I am or the things that I've gone through or experienced. Part of that is my autistic nature. I'm autistic, and I have, you know, issues with filter, as many of us autistic folk do. I don't know when to stop or where the line is, so it just all comes out. But I think it's very cathartic to write about yourself and your own experiences. It's really, really very healing in a way to be able to do that, and is a very therapeutic thing to be able to write. Not necessarily always about you or with you as the main character, but to write even in an abstract way about things and situations that you've experienced or found yourself in, and bring that out to the world and have other people then observe that or digest that.
Wonderful. And in terms of your writing, would you say your poetry offers you more of that kind of release, or your novel writing? I'm curious.
That's a really interesting question.
It's a really annoying question. And the answer can be, George, shut the fuck up. Both of them are equally expressive and cathartic to do.
Well, so they're not equally expressive. They are equitably expressive. So they both offer me very, very lovely ways to express myself, my thoughts, my words, my creativity. But they are very different. Poetry is very Poetry is almost like you're seeing the world through my eyes, and the poems that I write are what forms in my head when I observe something. So poetry to me is a way of sharing my observation on the world. And that's not an arrogant way of me saying my observations of the world are important somehow, but more just this is how I observe the world, and I write these as poems, and I put them there for the world to see because this is my perspective on the universe, and it's good to be able to learn about other people's perspectives and experiences. And I think poetry is an amazing way to learn about how other people see the world or see a particular situation. Whereas I think the fiction that I write is a way to explore different concepts and themes, but it is more entertainment. It is more an exploration. It is designed for, characters to develop and form. Whereas poetry, it has characters in it, but they're being observed by me. Whereas, and I'm kind of the narrator when it's a poem. Whereas in the fiction, it's a very different sort of feel, and you're very much going along the journey with a character instead. So they both offer me incredible ways to express not just my thoughts and ideas, but also commentary on the world and everything within it. But they just have completely different contexts in terms of how they've read, how they come across to people. As I think is always the way with poets who write fiction or fiction writers who write poetry and vice versa.
Yeah, and I think you're 100% right, and it's so vital, especially now when there's so much that people seem to be trying to divide us with, in terms of arguments about this person or that person or this group of people and that group of people, to have all of these wonderful individual perspectives on the world and to go into that journey with them, I think, and poetry is a wonderful way of doing that. Let's talk about your debut novel, Hidden Lives. Which is a gritty, funny, heartwarming look at the life of a queer teenager who's having some pretty weird dreams. How much of you went into that book?
I love Hidden Lives and I love the characters in it. And I often get asked, are any of them based on me? And the answer is no. I have written things before where I have featured or a version of me has featured as a character. But in the case of Hidden Lives, neither of the main characters or any of the kind of sub-characters are me in its entirety. But there are lots of different bits and pieces of different people in all of the characters. The main character, Aaron, is very much like a number of people that I've known, but also was really informed by some of the time I spent working in mental health and in healthcare in general. His kind of off again, on again partner, Dustin, is a whole different character that actually springs from a lot of people that I like a lot, and have a kind of confidence and an ease about them that I never have. So it was all that's almost a jealousy character. I wrote it because I'm like, oh, I wish I was more like this. And then there are other characters in the story that kind of are other people. So Aaron's mother, for example, is actually based on the mother of someone that I know. To the extent that I've even stolen some of the little phrases that she used to use with my friend's permission, to put in there, which is quite interesting. There's a head teacher and a trans mask teacher at the school that they both go to, both of whom are based on people that I know. And unfortunately, in the case of the head teacher, I have actually met head teachers that talk like that. You have to read the book to work out why, but you'll cringe, you'll go, this can't possibly be a real character. And I regret to tell you that it absolutely is.
My God, no, that especially sounds like it might have been quite cathartic to pin them to the page and say, this is your evil, kind of immortalized.
And it's true. And I used all of their catchphrases and I made them the most cringy character in the book. I'm like, you deserve this because you are like this in real life.
I mean, they say that, don't they? Don't piss off a writer because you will end up in a book.
Well, this person didn't so much piss me off as I just. Like there wasn't a single authentic thing about them. So that's the character.
Wow, that's savage. Absolutely savage. Do you think novels and fiction in particular have got a special place for being able to highlight issues in society to other people, to the reader, and maybe bring about some real change?
I think so, yeah. I think you don't have to look you don't have to look too hard to find great examples of that in history. I mean, look at 1984 by Orwell. That was a book that ended up becoming, through fiction, so heavily influential in many different ways. I mean, arguably, had 1984 not have been written, we would not be living in a world that was as much like 1984 as we are now. But ultimately, it was an interesting cautionary tale that I think we have all, we're all touched by on some level, whether we've read the book or not. Similarly, there is a fantastic book called Conversion Dysphoria Blues by an author called Rhys Asher. And in that, Rhys, who is a trans author, has written about the dysphoria experienced when a man in the future, his life is saved by being turned into a cyborg. And it basically tells the story of gender dysphoria, but using robots and in the future. So it's a way for people who maybe haven't experienced dysphoria and can't understand it from a gender perspective to maybe get a glimpse into how that might work by taking it and putting it into a different context. People have done that for years with plays as well. I was once in an opera, Dido and Aeneas, and that story is so timeless that we were able to actually take the whole thing and set it in space rather than in the 16th century, and it still made absolute sense as well.
Yeah, I love
And
that. That's incredible.
I mean, people do that all the time. I mean, the Chronicles of Narnia is essentially the Bible in story form. It's just taken and told in a slightly different way. There are lots of films that are basically just Hamlet or other plays that are kind of animated and turned into different stories. So it's super interesting to see how fiction can take an issue and contextualize it in a different way to educate an audience or a reader. I think that's part of the power of fiction. But also, fiction doesn't have to be informative. Fiction can just be entertainment, and that's great as well. And I want to categorically say that things like fan fiction are amazing and absolutely valid forms of fiction.
So you
And
started out doing fan fiction, didn't you?
I did, yes. And I love fan fiction. And it really irritates me when people say, oh, fan fiction, that's something that people, they graduate away from. I'm like, no, fan fiction is absolutely valid. I've read novel size fan fictions that were brilliant and absolutely fantastic stories, and fair play to anyone that gets inspired by something else and decides to continue that story or continue a theme from it or take those characters and put them somewhere else. I mean, that's amazing work, really.
Absolutely. And it's just one of those forms of snobbery that we find in the arts, unfortunately, especially in the literary world, which can absolutely put people off kind of participating. How do you see barriers to entry to writing and to creativity?
Well, I think that we have for a long time lived in a world where there are such unnecessary barriers to getting involved in anything in the arts. You want to play music somewhere, you've got to book a venue, there's a financial barrier, or you've got to be well known enough to be able to be asked to play at places, or you want to publish your music. That's easier than ever now with things like DistroKid and Bandcamp. But before, the barriers to entry there were high. It's the same with art. You can put stuff online, but there are risks associated with that. You want to do things more traditionally, you can't. It's still, we've almost got this two-tier system now of people see real art as the stuff that's not online, and the stuff that's online somehow has less intrinsic value because you can access it easier, and that's absolute crap. Everything has worth, and your worth as an artist isn't measured by how people can access your art. Someone could create some incredible artwork and post it on Tumblr, and its value, its worth as a piece of art is the same as anything in the Louvre, anything by Van Gogh, anything that other artists have created, because we cannot compare works of art for their worth. The same then
Absolutely. And
comes with writing. I mean, publishing, getting stuff published and written and out there for the world to see. I mean, that there's a huge barrier to entry there, and we're still in this unfortunate situation with writing in particular, where bigger publishers will not take a chance on someone who is not cishet or someone who is not white. The statistics are massively skewed towards white men and white women of British descent or American descent when it comes to publishing. And that's a crying shame, because some of the best writers out there are the people of color, are the trans folk, are the queer folk who are creating incredible stories, and they just don't get the same opportunities.
Yeah, it was really interesting, and I think I brought this up on a previous episode of the podcast. Obviously, it was written many years ago, but Ursula Le Guin put together kind of the statistics of who does get published and who does get the awards, and it's incredible to see the bias towards white cis men, especially even in genres where, maybe there's more women writers. The men are still the ones getting awards and getting recognition, which is absolutely fascinating. But yeah, in terms of people who aren't white, people who aren't cisgender, and ableism as well also plays a factor, I would say. It's just outrageous. And unfortunately, the more we have these narratives perpetuated and this divisive language in the media about trans people and immigrants who are invading our country, which is just, I can't even get onto that right now. The less publishers are going to be willing to take a chance, and it's just awful because we as the consumer of art are at the end of the day the ones who are suffering because we're not getting all this gorgeous, gorgeous, fantastic art.
Well, and also the representation matters as well. Of course,
Yes.
people are going to think that some people intrinsically have more worth than others if they aren't ever educated otherwise. And the way that we educate is by example. And it's criminal that we don't have a range of art, whether it's music or literature or painting or whatever, from a range of artists that are taught from day one at schools, that are part of everyone's bookshelf. It's just huge amounts of cultural bias, particularly here in the UK, that exclude people. And as a white, queer, autistic woman, I struggle to get anywhere with those things. And in fact, after I transitioned, I had far, far fewer opportunities ever come my way. So it is hard, and it is difficult for people, and we have to smash these barriers down. Thankfully, there are small queer sort of indie publishing houses for writers. I'm part of one of them. There are great places to be able to show your art that are kind of smaller and indie and queer, but we shouldn't be the subculture. We are at the moment because that's where we need to be, but we should be part of that mainstream. That mainstream should encompass everyone, because ultimately, people talk about eliminating difference. I don't think that's quite right, because we are all different. George, you and I are very different people, and we should be in a place where we celebrate those differences. And literally, rather than saying here's a group, here's a group, here's a group, we should acknowledge that every single person is different. And as soon as we acknowledge every single person is different, the groups melt away. The prejudice melts away, and we can celebrate those differences together. Right now, what we have is this intentional grouping and lumping together of people into us versus them, good versus bad, people versus trans people. And it's that kind of division and that kind of group thinking that just destroys art, and it destroys life, and it destroys opportunity.
That's an interesting point. What I would say is that, and this is my opinion, and I'd love to hear yours, in terms of categorizing and labeling people, yes, on the surface, that sounds terrible, but also it means that you can then protect some opportunities specifically for those people, which at the moment does seem important.
I agree completely. If we were in a perfect world, we would not need to protect opportunities because everyone would have them. Right now, we are living in a world of haves and have-nots. We are living in a world where So many opportunities go to the wealthy, go to the white men, go to cisgender and heterosexual people. So actually, it is important to carve out those spaces and to make sure that there are awards and titles and scholarships and particular counting of people who are from minority backgrounds, because right now we live in a society of majorities and minorities, and that's not okay.
Yeah, we need to create a platform for marginalized creatives so that they can be heard because representation does matter.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I think like complete social change, complete overhaul of all systems, erasing all borders and destroying all governments is really the way
Yes.
to go. But since I don't think that's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, making sure that we have good representation and have carved out spaces for queer folk is super important.
Yeah, and I love that Reconnecting Rainbows Press does that. I love that the place where you had your book launch, that is this wonderful safe space for queer people to go to. Also, it was an accessible venue, which was amazing. It was queer and accessible, which is like really rare in London.
Queer, accessible, dozen iced iced tea. I mean, there are lots of things it irritates me how inaccessible the city is for people with physical needs, but also for people with sensory needs. You know,
Yeah.
as an autistic person, I walk around this city and I struggle. You know, I struggle enough if I go somewhere and there are no gender neutral toilets or anything.
Yeah.
Then to add on top of that, is this place going to be too noisy? Isn't it going to become too noisy later? Is there a silly way of doing things here that I'm not going to be able to understand because it's not part of a social convention? You know, all of those things are huge barriers to entry for me. And then even then counting the physical barriers to entry that exist for people who are less mobile than I am is really difficult as well.
Yeah. And again, a complete overhaul would be lovely, but I don't think it's anything we can hold our breath for.
Demolish every building, make new ones. Make
Oh.
entirely recycled material. Let's make them all so they don't need any heating in the winter.
Oh
They
God,
don't
yeah.
need any cooling in the summer. And every toilet in the world has to be gender neutral.
And there have to be public toilets more kind of frequently around so that I don't have to like run to a toilet because being disabled and needing a wee in public is horrendous.
Public toilets are a thing that I think they've kind of fallen out of fashion because people were either using them for drugs or sex or both, and they were never getting cleaned and they were all a bit kind of scummy, which
Yeah.
is ridiculous because public toilets are a really useful public service. Because what is the one thing that everyone needs to do?
Yeah.
It is in some way, shape, or form evacuate fluids from their body. And a public bathroom is a great way to do that. There's got to be a
I
way
was
of
talking
having
about
good,
this with
accessible ones.
sorry. I was talking about this with a guy in a cooperative, and he was saying, like it's just a basic right. Like to be able to go to the bathroom. And then there's also all these opportunities like, well, hang on, you could put adverts up in there so somebody could make money, you could sell products in there. I know like turning a toilet into a capitalistic kind of machine isn't great, but there's opportunity in it and it could work for everybody and kind of be helpful as well. I think toilets are a really interesting topic, which is why I host a podcast so I can talk about toilets.
Well, personally, I think toilets are great art galleries. You should have art on the wall of all sorts.
Yes.
Toilet cubicles should have paintings and portraits in them. Heck, you should have copies of books in public toilets. I will donate a copy of every single I will donate a copy of both of my books to each public toilet in London.
It would have to be like pasted on the walls because you don't want people like handling the book while they're on the toilet. Because,
That's a fair point. I hadn't
yeah.
considered the future. Well, that's okay. We can
I
just wallpaper a cubicle with the story, varnish over it. That's perfect.
Yes,
Just have to
I'm so here for that. I'm so here for that.
where to start. But I like it. I think what would be really fun in a toilet cubicle is one of those choose your own adventure things. You're like, you're
Oh.
over here on the top left, and suddenly you're bottom right, and then it's like, I'll move around a bit.
Can you imagine the queues though?
I take a long time in the toilet anyway.
I think we're really onto something. We should market this idea to somebody.
What people do, they scroll their phones while they're on the toilet, right? The old squat and
Yeah,
serve.
that's
So
true.
we should make that into art enjoyability instead.
Again, though, this is artists kind of expected to give their work for free without getting paid and then it being devalued. But also their art doesn't mean anything if people don't pay money for it. So you've got a lot going on there.
Yeah, I mean, we would have to compensate artists, whether in, I mean, I really, really dislike the idea of public toilets that are paid for, and I think no public toilet should be paid for. But if they keep insisting on charging for public toilets, then that money should just go to the artists.
Yeah, or like a percentage of it. Could you imagine? I would choose to go in a public toilet that I had to pay for if there was art on the walls that I could enjoy, and some of the proceeds went to the artist.
Yeah, I agree completely. And
So, I just
I think
heard
it...
myself and I was like, I'm not on drugs.
No, we are actually talking about toilets.
It's been like 5 minutes. Okay, I'm gonna move us on. Otherwise, I'm going to have to rename this podcast like Cabinet of Water Closets.
Yeah, well, Portaloo of
Yeah.
Curiosities, I think we call it.
Portaloo of Curiosities. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Kestrel. That's it. That's what we can call our ingenious idea. Portaloo of
The Portaloo
Curiosities.
of Curiosities. I like it actually. Why don't we just go and buy a few Portaloos, cover them in art, and we can probably charge a fortune for them at like antiques festivals and things.
I'm
And
so in for this
and
idea.
all of the money we make from it goes to everyone's like top surgery crowdfunders.
Yes, that would be or a new wheelchair for people like me or
That's proper Robin Hooding. I like it.
Oh my God. Okay. I'm gonna bring us back. I'm gonna bring us back. So
Get us out of the gutter.
on the wonderful form that you filled out for me, thank you so much for filling it out. You wanted to talk about how not everyone knew they were trans as a kid, and some of us transitioned already having a body of work. How do you deal with the dead coming back to life?
Yeah, so it's really difficult when you're already established to then suddenly realize that you're trans. And you transition. But if you want to keep any of your old work, you kind of have to keep dead naming yourself, which is really difficult.
Oof.
And I think a lot of people struggle with this. So I have friends that have, essentially had hundreds of academic papers in their dead names, and they've had to basically give them up because
Yeah.
you can't really change your name on things. I mean, I had a previous book published under an old name that I just don't have anymore because I don't use that name anymore, and I've taken some of the bits out of it and used it in other works, which is fine,
Yeah.
but it's difficult for people who maybe don't come out as trans as a kid and do it later in life, and we've already done stuff. I mean, I had a under my dead name, I had a TED talk, I had about 12 different conference talks on YouTube and various different kind of articles. And I used to write a column in a magazine. And like, I can't really show that to anyone because it's all under my dead name and I can't get any of it changed.
That must be absolutely awful. That there should be an option where, everything just gets mass changed for you. You don't have to go and track it all down. Somebody else does the admin,
Well, and that was really why I wanted to raise it, because there's got to be a better way, like collectively as artists, as writers and painters and performers and jugglers and everyone, we should be able to come up with a convention for what happens to people who are trans. Like you transition, like Elliot Page is a great example. Elliot Page, the credits have been changed in a lot of his older work. In some of it hasn't, but it's generally acknowledged Elliot Page is Elliot Page and things have changed. Fine. But Elliot did a really public transition. A lot of people want to get away from their old name, from their dead name, and not have to revisit it. There has to be some kind of protocol within our communities for us to say, this is what you do, this is how we deal with that collectively as artists. And here are the platforms that allow you to do that. Because, you know, some websites or some publishers will be quite forthcoming and others won't be. And some of you, them will want to charge you hundreds of pounds and some of them will do it for free. And we haven't got that kind of crowdsourced and crowdfunded list of stuff in terms of publishing or in the arts world or anything like that. And I think we probably need to come together and do that. So I think my kind of call to action, my call to arms would be if you, not just you, George, but you as in the listener, the royal you, have thoughts, ideas, if you're interested in kind of getting together and trying to work something out with this, what happens to artists when they transition and they no longer want to be referred to by their dead name? Let's work on this together. Let's put something together. Let's build a website or whatever that has lists on it. Let's do something because it's hard for people. And I think it's super important that we try and make it better and easier for people who transition.
I am completely on board, and I will say that's a fantastic call to arms. If anyone listening to this podcast, please go onto my Instagram, A underscore G underscore Parker, I think. Find the post with Kestrel's face on it for this episode and comment underneath if you want to be involved in something like that, if you've already started something like that, because that would benefit so many people. I know for myself, luckily, when I started writing, I chose the pen name AG Parker. It's very a bit of a long-winded story. It's not really as straightforward as a transitioning name, but I was in an abusive relationship, and so my first name I couldn't hear without getting extremely triggered. So I adopted a name that my friend and at the time yoga teacher gave me, which was Amara. So I became Amara George Parker. All my writing was under AG Parker. Now when I see Amara George Parker, I'm like, vomit, that's disgusting. And earlier this year, I changed my legal name to George Violet Parker. I still write under AG Parker, but if I see Amara, I feel physically sick, because that's too feminine to me as a non-binary person right now. I can't really cope with that. So George Violet Parker is how I prefer to be known. But yeah, going back to publications that I publish stuff with regularly and having to see that dead name is really quite challenging. So let's come together on this and let's all, Kestrel, I'm 100% behind you.
Let's do it. Let's make it happen, George. Let's start this campaign.
Oh my God, let's do, two fantastic ideas have come out of this episode.
I love it. I think this one is probably a little easier to do than the Portaloos, but
I don't
I'll
know
keep an
because
eye out for some used Portaloos.
tracking down, can you imagine tracking down your entire body of work that's got your dead name on it and changing it? And then how does somebody else do that? Because how do they verify that it's the right Amara George Parker? I'm going to use my own name, because do you know what I mean? It's that's quite a
We could
logistical issue.
even combine the two things. And for artists that have dead name works, your dead name works is printed on the toilet paper, so people can literally wipe their asses with your old work whilst reading your new work.
I mentioned, I absolutely adore you, and it's such a privilege to have you on this podcast.
I'm not always, I'm always busy, but you know, my ideas aren't always winners. Like
No, they're
I'm a little bit
fantastic.
eccentric.
It's so good. I'm really here for it. So I don't know if you've listened to the show before, but what I try to remember to ask my guests every time is if you were a mythical creature, and this goes off George the Dragon, because non-binary, pansexual, disabled feel like a mythical creature, get treated like a total weirdo, like, ooh. So if you were a mythical creature, what would you be and why?
Does it have to be mythical or can it be a creature that exists?
Oh, I mean, the question was mythical.
That's
Just
true. Okay.
yeah,
I'm going to think
but
about
you could
this
be
one.
an extinct creature or a rare creature or like, yeah, be whatever you want to be. I'm not gonna judge.
A mythical creature. I mean, in terms of one that's maybe extinct, I think I'd be a dodo.
Oh, why?
Because they looked kind of comical and very colourful and a bit weird. And that's me all over, really, just colourful and weird.
That's perfect.
I think also perhaps a phoenix, in terms of mythical creatures. I really like the idea of rebirth. I mean, we're all different people all throughout our lives, and the only constant is change. And the we are a sum of all of our choices and experiences, and we can, give birth to a new version of ourselves anytime we like. And I think nothing represents that more than a phoenix.
That is wonderful. I love that. I've got a phoenix tattooed on my back for that very reason. And I think, and I know some people were supposed to say like the queer community isn't better than the straight community. No one's better than anyone else. But I do think that the queer community has got that figured out in a way that a lot of straight, cishet, normative people don't. And I think the idea that we are these beings that change and we evolve, I think that openness to that is just something really special.
I don't think it's a case of being better or worse, but I think there is a shared queer experience that is, we are the people that have had to do the most work on ourselves. We have looked inside, we have done the thinking, we have put the thought into things. We are living life on hard mode, which is a phrase that is often used. But the amount of experience you get from that is different to people that live life on easy mode. That's why people that play games on hard mode get higher scores than people that play games on easy mode. That applies, and it's not about scores, and it's not about being the best or getting the highest score. But queer people are so much more vibrant, are so much more experienced in the world in general. Obviously, not all of them. I know some queer idiots, but it's all about, I implicitly trust queer people more than non-queer people because I know that they've been through stuff. I know that they will have been through more than the average person. They will have had to do a whole bunch of introspection and a whole bunch of figuring things out and a whole bunch of having really difficult conversations with people and with themselves. And that adds character and strength and fortitude and it grows people in a way that I think is really difficult to say, really difficult to quantify, but it's there. It's really important part of the queer experience. And I don't think that we're better than cishet people, but we're certainly a lot more interesting.
I do want to clarify so I don't get so I don't get cancelled. definitely not saying one group of people is better than another group of people. But yeah, just trying to kind of phrase it in a way. I think you phrased it a lot better than I did, which often happens on this show because my brain fog really does. It's like being, shot in the leg, limping around, which I also do. Yeah, the introspection has led us somewhere. And like you say, hashtag not all queer people, because there are some very close-minded conservative queer people as well. But I think having that ability to look at yourself and realize that, you have changed, you can change, you will continue to change and grow is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Yeah, I'm a bit worried that I actually just very easily played into a divisive narrative there of one group is better than the other.
That's okay, don't worry. I mean,
I'll drink more tea.
being queer is all about looking at ourselves and learning. And
I've
when
learned
you
I'm a
look like
dick.
us, when you look like us, George, of course you're going to want to look at yourself. I mean,
That is very true. That is very true. Clearly, I've run out of good words to put in a straight line. So, have you got any poetry, any extracts that you'd like to share with my fabulous audience?
do I have any words that I would like to put into a straight line for you?
They don't have to be straight, they can be very queer.
Yes, I would love to share something with you.
Fabulous.
I think I'll read you a poem if that's okay.
That's more than okay. Please read away.
Yes, so I would like to share with you a poem that I've written called Comic Sans. And this is very much playing into my nerdy side, a bit of a love of different typefaces, but is about a relationship I had where, well, chalk and cheese is perhaps an understatement. So this is Comic Sans, and this is in my book Counterweights, which is currently out on Reconnecting Rainbows Press. I laugh at funerals, You're the one in black clothes. I'm there making light, but everyone knows. While I'm smiles and sunshine, you'll be down below with your sad, somber melancholy, lights turned way down low. Through this cacophony of ever-changing ups and downs, I wonder if I'll make you smile instead of always making you frown. Opposites we, you and me, living here in such disharmony, never feeling calm. You see criticism banned. You shut out the things that you can't plan. Your Times New Roman, but I'm all Comic Sans. I'm always positive. You're always play it safe. I'm always doesn't matter. You're always assigning blame. Don't see the point in helping others. What are we to do? I find it difficult when you can only think of you. Opposites we, you and me, cooped up hating one another like some perverted dramatic soap opera. Should we change the channel or stick to our misguided plans? You are always Times New Roman, but I'm more Comic Sans.
Brilliant. I absolutely love that. And I know that quite a lot of the writers listening are going to be envisaging Comic Sans and probably cringing. But I do love that poem. Do you really prefer Comic Sans as a typeface?
So actually, no. I would never use Comic Sans as a typeface, but it does represent my personality quite nicely.
Well, oh my God, that should be my next kind of standard guest question. What font would you be and why?
I quite like that. Yeah, I should ask people that at interviews and things.
Definitely. I love that poem. That's fantastic. And that is in Counterweights, which is currently on sale. Where can people find it?
Well, so you can go to reconnectingrainbows.co.uk and there's a list of places to stock it. But across the UK, if there's a queer independent bookshop, you can generally get it there. It's at Gay's the Word and Common Press and the Anarchist Bookshop in London. You can walk into a bookshop like Waterstones and say, hello, I'd quite like this book, and they'll order it for you if they don't have it on the shelves, which it's unlikely they will. You can also order it online from Blackwells or Foyles. And if you really want to give more money to Jeff Bezos, space billionaire, you can
Boom.
get it on Amazon too.
Wow, fantastic. That gives us lots of options. Thank you.
If you
And
happen to pop into the Common Press in London on a weekend, there's kind of a 70% chance that I'll be sat in there writing anyway. So come in and buy one from there, and I'll even sign it for you.
oh my God, what a wonderful. You are going to get people stalking you now.
That's okay. I didn't tell anyone where I lived, just what bookshop I like to sit in and write.
Will you get any writing? You're going to have a list of people wanting to have their book signed, and you won't actually be able to write.
I think you're maybe overestimating my
I
popularity.
don't know. I don't know. Anyway, and for people who want to stalk you on social media in a nice consensual kind of stalking way, all of your links are going to be put in the description of this podcast. So please follow Kestrel because she is absolutely wonderful and always has lots of cool stuff going on. Kestrel, have you got any final words for our listeners?
I think whoever you are, thank you for taking the time to listen to my random ramblings and kind of various assorted thoughts. Just do the thing, whatever the thing is that is in your head that you're like, oh, I kind of want to do that, but I haven't, or I don't, or I can't. Just do it. Do the thing. I am here, random disembodied voice of a trans person named after a bird, and I am telling you, do the thing. You can do it. You should do it. Just do it. Do the thing.
I love that. That is very, very wise advice. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Kestrel, for your time and your wonderful ideas and wisdom
My
today.
pleasure.
And just to top it all off, we've got something really special here. We've got Kestrel's piece, Birds and Humans, sung by the Melbourne Women's Choir. So please enjoy.
Birds above, God to soothe.
Until next time, stay curious.